The Conservatives are the largest party. They don't have an overall majority at this stage. The Prime Minister called this election because she wanted certainty and stability. This doesn't seem to look like certainty and stability.
Welcome to Polling Politics. This week's podcast is sponsored by Ladbrokes Political Betting. Hello and welcome to Polling Politics, the election edition.
Ooh!
I'm Joe Twyman from Delta Poll.
And I'm Marie LeConte.
Every week during the election campaign, Marie and I are going to round up the key political stories and statistics of that week. And we're going to be joined by a top guest from the world of politics to delve into polling and public opinion in more detail. The news this week is the election. And our guest is Will Jennings. Hello, Will.
Hello.
Will is Professor of Political Science at the University of Southampton. Among other things, he's involved with election polling at Sky News and the Centre for Towns. So, Will, let's kick off as we're going to kick off with every guest each week of the campaign. How's your election going?
It's been a little bit busy so far because, you know, academics who work on elections, when elections called, you know, your bosses don't say drop everything, start looking at the election. So I'm trying to juggle about five different existing projects, trying to think about what I might do on election night.
Must be dreadful to have to put that one lecture a week on hold.
Terrible.
There's been a lot of comment about the role of academics in public life generally, but particularly with regards to elections and election predictions. Where do you see the role of academics being in that respect?
Well, I've been on a bit of a journey as far as election predictions goes, to be fair to say. I got a little bit confident in 2010 when I was a part of a team that predicted, that had a model that predicted the constituency results pretty well from national polls, because in 2010, the polls did pretty well. And in 2015, things went a little bit wrong, as you know, because I was a member of the inquiry into you. And so at that point, I started to think a little bit more critically about what people like me do in terms of predicting elections, to think about the uncertainty. And so while I'm a really big believer and supporter of polling as a way of understanding the mood of the country, I try, when I'm thinking about what might go on, to actually caveat with all the uncertainties about polling, but also about voters. I think voters are actually very volatile. And so my view now is that prediction, if done well, is actually a valuable thing, but if done in a kind of style of punditry that's just about driving excitement and kind of fulfilling a narrative, then that can be quite damaging.
You've also been involved with investigations into historic polling and the levels of accuracy, both in this country.
I'm very sorry, I'm just picturing, so you know, like when they go to the cool cases, you know, plays in sort of like police dramas.
NCIS, pollster. CSI.
You've got a nice one from 1987.
Will, tell us, ignore Marie, and tell us about that.
Well, I mean, it speaks to one of these issues actually about kind of people learning the wrong lesson. So one of the interesting things that we've had in the last few years is that everyone now says, oh, we can't trust polls. I'll never trust another poll again. Well, actually, polls have a pretty good record, and certainly a better record than lots of the other wacky methods that are out there that put out. Someone comes and says, oh, I've got this AI Facebook model that will predict in this constituency the result down to a T. If you actually look at polling historically going back over 70 years, and like we did a study in 50 countries, polling actually is a pretty stable predictor of how election results are going to go. There are elections where they get it wrong. I think there are also elections, funnily enough, where people read the polls overconfidently or take a narrative out far more strongly than actually would be based on the polls. And so I think if you look at the historical record, polls, despite the fact they've completely changed, are actually a pretty good indicator of what's going on.
But I find that quite interesting, actually, on the topic of the kind of narratives as well, because straight after, I think, the Brexit referendum, so many people, and even afterwards, well, even now, you know, said, well, you know, but all the polls were saying that Remain was going to win. It's like, well, that's not true, actually. If you look at the polls in the last few weeks and the run-up to the 23rd of June, quite a few polls said that Leave would win. But it's just that because, you know, because the noise around it said Remain will win, then, you know, it was assumed that all the polls would as well. So it is as much, I think, about the narrative around the polls than it is about the actual numbers.
We had exactly the same thing in 2006. 17, whereas actually people say, oh, the polls in 17 didn't tell us. Well, actually, they were the best, they were the most accurate polls on the Conservative vote share that had been in the post-war era, right? They got Labour a little bit wrong, but even on that, they told a story about their campaign that was totally right, which was that Labour was well behind when they started and they were gaining at the end. So actually, you looked at the polls in that election, they tell you everything you needed to know about the election campaign.
What we get time and again is people saying, oh, yeah, but you had the Conservatives well ahead at the start of the campaign. And we say, well, Yes, that's exactly what we had. And then they weren't well ahead at the end because the campaign hadn't been very good. And I think that talks to the fact that these are not predictions. These are saying where we are at the moment. But again, I think that's something that people get confused, understandably.
But isn't it as well, I guess, the other point on that, that supposedly that received wisdom for quite a long time and until quite recently was that the short campaign normally didn't change much. So it was kind of like, well, actually, whatever happens to the short campaign, you know, is basically useless, whereas obviously 2017 changed. And I think that's probably why everyone now is saying, ha-ha, I'm going to be clever and say the short campaign will change everything because we've seen it once, when historically that's quite rare.
Yeah, and political scientists often say actually campaigns don't matter to the extent they cancel each other out, right? So that in a campaign you have two parties being, you know, more or less kind of as effective in campaigning. And so whatever these effects of political ads or kind of campaign messages or these kind of grand events all cancel out because it's almost noise against each other. And you're completely right. I mean, I think everyone now is thinking we're going to see this great Labour surge. When you say that was quite unusual, we could just as likely have the stability of people's voting intentions over the campaign that we saw in 2015. You just can't assume that suddenly we're going to have the same thing.
Just as long as Jacob Rees-Mogg remains locked in a closet somewhere down CCHQ until the 12th of December.
But a lot of voters aren't even paying attention to that, right? You know, that's
certainly
that's
not at the moment.
No, and you know, and people make their decision up late. They don't pay attention to the sorts of things that people like us who are obsessed with politics are looking at. And so they all get their news and a kind of couple of minutes snippet on the 10 o'clock news or what have you, not through detailed kind of research on Twitter every day.
There's an interesting point, I think, about the historical precedence, because if you look at the polling at the moment, the Tories are on 40% in the latest Delta Poll survey. That's slightly down on their share of the vote from the 2017 election, but it's well ahead of Labour on 28%. Then when it comes to the underlying data, nearly half of people say that Boris Johnson is doing well in his job, compared to only a quarter who say the same about Jeremy Corbyn. Similarly, when given the choice between the two main parties, the Conservatives are seen as the best party by some distance to deal with the issue of Brexit and to manage the economy. Now, historically, it's never been the case that a party has come from behind on economic management and leadership to not win at least the most seats. Is that the kind of rule that you think will hold again this time around? Because my sense is it probably will, but of course the most seats doesn't necessarily mean a majority.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a big believer of kind of iron laws of politics, right? And we're living in very volatile times with these strange new identities of Leave and Remain that are kind of just distorting what we thought was normal politics. But equally, you'd say, well, of course the Conservatives should be the favourites to win more seats. They're, you know, probably just about, you'd think, that they quite possibly would get a majority. But that said, you know, the nature of our electoral geography at the moment, the fact we've got very regionalised electoral competitions, you know, you expect the Lib Dems are going to be strong in parts of the south where they historically have been strong that voted Remain. There are bits of the north where you might think Brexit Party would mess up the Conservative challenge, or parts of the country where you have this kind of anti-Tory norm of people still, you know, having these memories of the 1980s and the kind of social economic shocks of that period who don't want to vote for the Conservatives. I mean, Merseyside's a great example of a place.
Can't see them voting for Boris Johnson anytime soon.
No, exactly. I mean, you know, but you know, they you know, according to demographics, there are large parts of the kind of Merseyside region that you'd have said, oh, they might have voted, you know, based on the sorts of kind of demographic who live there for UKIP and the Brexit Party, not going anywhere near them. So actually, then you start to look at the kind of regional patterns, it becomes a much more complicated election.
Which is what makes it so difficult to take the share of the vote and convert that into possible seat outcomes, and brings into doubt the size of the Conservative majority, or if indeed there be a majority at all. Now, you've been involved with the Centre for Towns as well.
Which one's your favourite town?
My favourite town. Well, we have a debate around whether cathedral town should be a category. So
Definitely not. Cathedral town is just a poor man's city.
Well, in the centre of the towns, I'm the southern outlier, and Lisa Nandy accuses me of being a Tory on account of where I live.
Well, you are sitting here wearing a tie and a suit.
Exactly, and a blue suit. All
nothing
the same.
Else, so that's a bit weird, but yeah.
So, you know, well, I mean, you know, I think one can't get away from the town that you kind of grew up in. So I grew up in Winchester, and that's where I live now, so that would be my favourite town.
Do you think that the Conservatives have done enough to win over the kind of seats that it's predicted they need to win in the Northern Leave Labour areas?
I think in a lot of those areas have drifted away from Labour over quite a long period due to the change, you know, kind of the changing nature actually of British electoral politics and our economy and society. So there are certainly towns that are quite marginal that historically have been held by Labour where the traditional Labour vote has been kind of declining over a 40-year period. So certainly you'd say the Conservatives present a challenge in some of those places, but even still, in a lot of those places, there are still quite strong roots of the Labour movement, the social institutions. You know, we heard the last week a lot about kind of rugby league towns, right? Well, actually, one of the things I think that isn't talked about enough about what Britain's economic history and industrial history left behind was actually a huge number of social institutions like sports clubs, right? Where actually were organised around workplaces. And so there are some parts of some industrial towns that have gone closer to the Conservatives than others. But I think there's still a lot of towns that have quite a residual loyalty towards Labour, which make it difficult for the Conservatives to kind of suddenly sweep the board.
And in this kind of areas you talked about with the Lib Dems wanting to dominate in the south, university towns, metropolitan cities, areas of London, for instance, can you see the Remain vote splitting between Labour, Lib Dems and others, and perhaps letting in the Conservatives, even if their vote share is reduced in those constituencies?
Well, I think we're going to see, a very geographically variable story, right? So there are some constituencies where Labour in the south, where Labour doesn't figure at all, and where you'd expect the Liberal Democrats to kind of clean up the Remain vote. There are other seats certainly in London, where the vote's more fragmented, where there really is a possibility that Remain voters won't quite know which way to turn. They might be a little bit dissatisfied with Labour's position on Brexit. It's a bit unclear as to how much clarity the campaign's going to give people on that. And you might then see the vote split between those two and the Conservatives be let in. I think across the board, with the challenge of the Brexit Party, we're going to see people winning constituencies on smaller shares of the vote than they did in 2017.
My question as well is, because I think this is basically going to be quite a weird election in that it was basically called because of Brexit. People are quite likely to end up voting the way they do because of Brexit, but everything in the middle will be all the parties trying to talk about everything but Brexit. So what's that going to look like, actually? You know, like each party trying to talk about the NHS or crime or whatever, but at the end of the day, Brexit will kind of be this major factor that will not, I think, be discussed as much as it should be.
It's a very strange election. I mean, I think, one reason for that is simply that the Conservatives know that the more attention there is to their deal that Boris Johnson negotiated, the more it is unlikely to unravel in terms of the criticisms that can be made of it. And so I actually think the weird thing about this election is just kicking the can further down the road as to what's going to happen. And I think, although if you pushed me, I would say I think the Conservatives might win a small majority, I actually think they're going to face real challenge if they are able to form a government, because they're going to have to mobilise support for the deal that they've negotiated, get it through, put some sort of trade deal together, who knows in 10 months what they can do. And with a small, probably with not a huge majority, and we could end up in a situation where we have an election actually relatively soon again in next year.
My thinking is that if Boris Johnson doesn't get the majority, then he ceases to be Prime Minister. I think he's probably burnt enough bridges in the House to prevent that happening. And if he doesn't get a majority of 20 to 25, he's not going to be able to deliver on his Brexit promises.
No, absolutely. I think he needs 40, 50 seats to be able to sustain a government for the full term. And I think without that, although we've had this exodus of, the kind of so-called moderate MPs from this parliament, the people who were saying, well, actually, we don't like no deal. I think even with that exodus, there will be people on the Conservative benches who say, steady on, we're a little bit worried about the potential implications of no deal. And I think you actually could see different people being the rebels in 6 months' time.
No, just sorry, as a side note, it's such a sign of the times that you were just talking about the idea of a 5-year mandate. And I was like, ha! How fanciful! Yeah. A Prime Minister staying for 5 years.
No elections within 5 years.
It just sounded really odd. It sounded weirdly jarring.
but in a month's time, we could all be sitting around laughing. So, oh, well, we won't be back here for another 5 years with this 100-seat majority.
Alternatively, in a month's time, we could be forecasting that we could see a second referendum on Europe, second referendum on Scottish independence, a second general election, and who knows what else in the next 12 months. It would be quite interesting to say... say the least.
You can't even finish that sentence.
No, exactly. It's such is my shock at the thought of it. The polling around Boris Johnson's deal suggests that actually a majority of the country support it, and more Brexit Party voters support it than oppose it. My sense is that's probably because it's not been open to a great deal of scrutiny. That will play heavily in the campaign?
No, because I think what they've got is a deal in inverted commas that they can sell as we've solved Brexit and we can get it done. The Conservatives won't want to get into any detail, because as soon as you start unravelling the complexity of this is just a withdrawal agreement, it's not even a deal, people who support Brexit might say, well, that's not quite the Brexit I was looking for. I wanted something slightly different. And Nigel Farage from the sidelines can shout, that's certainly not the real thing. And so I think we will hear very little about the details of what's been negotiated. And there'll be much more talk about getting Brexit done and this kind of these wonderful trade deals that we're going to get down the line. But, you know, the reason that Johnson's been able to get, you know, notionally more support among the public for the deal is simply because he's trusted on the issue. And it's like it's kind of basically the kind of the causality is all the wrong way around, right? It's not actually because the deal that he's negotiated is any better than Theresa May's. Many would argue it's far worse in terms of what the prospect it offers, you know, economically and so forth. It's far more than just, you know, Boris Johnson is seen as someone who will stand up for Brexit, and therefore people trust him. The problem is that sort of queue only lasts so long, and as soon as you get the detail, as Theresa May found, it can all fall apart.
But also I think that to an extent the withdrawal agreement in whatever form it's taken throughout the past few months was never really about what was in it. Because I think one thing I consistently found really striking quite early on was, you know, when Conservative MPs started saying, oh, well, you know, started going against May's agreement was, well, you know, I can't possibly, you know, my constituents, you know, will hate this. I can't possibly defend it, whatever. And it's like, no, that's not true. The fact is no one, you know, I, a political journalist, will not be reading the full withdrawal agreement and, you know, with the certainty that I don't understand everything. It is up to you, the Conservative MP, to explain to your constituents why that's a good deal and make that case for the deal. And then if they're still not happy, obviously, you know, you can have a chat. But I think it was a complete failure as well of politics. And again, I agree. I think it comes back to trust as well, and the fact that, you know, your Ben Bradleys, etc., did not feel that they could trust Theresa May on Brexit. But I think it was never fundamentally about what was in it. Like, the backstop probably would have been fine if more Tory MPs had been like, yeah, this seems all right.
No, I think the other issue is that we and politicians haven't communicated to people that this isn't even the final deal. And when we talk about it as a deal, we say, I mean, actually think the word deal is really unhelpful.
The fact that it's the start of the beginning, not the beginning of the end.
Not anything like it. And so I think people, I mean, I think the really toxic thing potentially for politics in the longer term is that people think that we'll get a new government, you know, Boris Johnson will get his new deal in and we can go off and think about other issues. Well, we're going to be dealing with this for, you know, 10, 20 years. We're going to be dealing with the economic consequences, certainly of the deal that seems to be on offer, and it seems to be quite a hard Brexit, seems certainly to kind of would suggest a kind of more austere time that aren't going to sustain the sort of promises on spending, public spending that have been made recently. So I think there's a really toxic mix that is just being stored up for years down the line that we're going to be coping with for a very long time.
But isn't it as well, I think, a failure of the Continuity Remain campaign, where I find that, you know, had I been a sort of, you know, Remain campaigner post 23rd of June 2016, surely what you'd want to do is actually, you know, any time that Theresa May, first Boris, whoever goes, you know, in this deal, whatever, is make the voters understand that, you know, that's only the beginning. All of this thing that's just happened, that's taken so long, that everyone's arguing about, that was super hard and super complex. Guys, that was step one of like 80. So do you really want to do this? And it's quite interesting that no one has really been doing that, which you know, I think would have struck me as quite a good way to turn people against the idea of Brexit.
I mean, I think the whole thing has been imploded on both sides. So I think on the Leave side, there was, you know, and Theresa May's approach was just a complete unwillingness until it was too late to compromise. I think had Theresa May taken a much more consensual approach that tried to say, well, you know, we voted to leave, but actually we need to take an approach that brings the whole country together, brings all the parliament together, I think there was much more possibility of building cross-party consensus. And on the Remain side, I think there's just still a lack of clarity about what is it that you want? What is it about, you know, first of all, what is it that's so great about the EU that you want to keep? But actually, what really is it that, you know, that you're not happy with? And I think the failure in communication there is just so systemic as to the way we talk about Brexit. I think we get sidelined by slogans, we get sidelined by these kind of weird details that we get caught up with without actually having honest conversations about it. And I actually think, you know, the one thing that you would have to say that, you know, you could maybe Remainers should acknowledge, the reason it's really difficult to get out of the EU is because the Leavers were right that we were heavily integrated into the EU, and that was the point. And so actually Remainers should say, yeah, that's fair enough. We are really heavily integrated, and that's why it's going to take a very long time. It's going to be painful, and we should have an honest conversation about it. But, you know, politics has meant, and the majoritarian style of British politics means that we can't have that conversation. And then both the major parties, Labour and Conservatives, have tried to use it for partisan gain at different points.
We're joined now by our old friend, Matthew Shaddock, head of political betting at Ladbrokes. Hello, Matthew. Good to see you again.
Hi, Joe.
So let's start at the beginning. What do the markets look like heading into this general election?
Well, I think it's kind of interesting because more or less every poll for the last few weeks is suggesting there's going to be a Tory majority, right? I think generally people think that a sort of at least a 5 or 6 point lead for the Tories is going to be enough for them to get a majority. And the average is about 10 or 11, their lead at the moment, right? But the betting markets are taking a contrary view. They think that a hung parliament is still the most likely outcome. That's odds on now. I think that's a bit odd myself, because normally the betting markets are a fairly good reflection of where the polls are. I kind of think that people are following too closely the general sort of media punditocracy about this election.
Punditocracy is a fantastic word.
You know, because when people come on the TV or they write their columns about this, trying to make predictions about this election, everyone seems to be saying more or less the same thing, which is the Tories are going to lose X number of seats in Scotland. They're going to lose lots of seats to the Liberal Democrats in the south of England. By that time, they're going to be 30 or 40 seats behind where they need to be to get a majority. They're going to have to win all those off Labour in the Midlands and the North in Leavey-type seats. And when you get down to seat number 30 or 40 on those lists, it's like Sedgefield or some impossible seat where, you know, partisan, tribal history, blah, blah, blah. They can't win those seats. Therefore, it's going to be a hung parliament. But I'm not so sure.
But what I'm finding quite amusing, actually, is that it's very obviously, I think, the case that a lot of the pundits feel a bit silly post-2017 of, like, all of them having called this massive Tory majority, and obviously that didn't happen. And then also they're all predicting a hung parliament. It's a bit like, well, no, the problem... I mean, obviously the problem was partly that you called it wrong, but the problem was mostly that, A, you all called the same thing, and B, you all sounded so certain. So instead of, you know, learning the lesson that maybe don't sound so certain, what they've learned is, oh, no, Tory majority wrong, other thing right, which I'm not sure how productive that is, really.
I totally agree. I think people are over-commentating for 2017. And it kind of seems naive just to say, oh, well, here are the polls. It shows the Tory majority. That's probably what's going to happen. The clever thing to say is, well, to be a bit careful, this could go a completely different way. And my personal view is the betting market has gone too far with that story. And I'm personally betting on a majority being the more likely outcome.
How do polls affect the betting markets when they're released?
Yeah, they affect it too much, really. If an individual poll were to come out today, say, let's say, showing it really getting a lot closer, Labour within 5 points or something, the betting markets would totally overreact to that. Instead of saying what everyone else says, which is all the experts say, which is it's only one poll, one data point, stand back and be calm about this, people will overreact. And then another poll will come out and people will go back to where they were before. So if you're the kind of person who's able to sort of stand back from that and be a bit calmer about things, then there's definitely some sort of betting opportunities there, whereas you let everyone else overreact and just do the opposite thing.
Every week we're going to be delving down into the detail of one particular constituency, and this time we've chosen Kensington. Obviously a win for Labour there last time around, which attracted an awful lot of attention. What are the betting markets in that area looking like?
I'm guessing this is going to be the most bet on seat of the entire election. It looks really interesting. As you say, big shock win for Labour last time. But actually they're in third place in the betting here. The Tories are just about odds on favourites to win this. Seems kind of incredible, given that we're talking about a very pro-Remain seat in the middle of London. But I guess people are expecting the Lib Dems will pick up so many Labour votes, they'll split their Remain votes. Tories just stay still on what they were in 2017 and win. So the Tories are 5-6. Lib Dems are actually second favourites. Big move for them once they announced Sam Gyimah as a candidate. I think he could do quite well there. They were 20-1 a few months ago to win this seat, now 9-4. And Labour out of 3-1, outsider of 3.
Actually, what I'm finding quite interesting in that seat, because you mentioned that there's the assumption that the Lib Dem candidate, Sam Gyimah, will pick up a lot of Labour votes. But I'm not actually entirely sure that'll be the case. I thought actually Sam's defection to the Lib Dems was quite curious, because he's not a Liberal Democrat, to be blunt. You know, he's not, if you look economically, he was, you know, he's very much on the kind of more free markets, was on the side of, you know, the Conservative Party. So if I were the Labour Party in Kensington, I'd find it actually quite easy, I think, to attack Sam Gyimah as the Lib Dem candidate. So I'm not sure. I could see him picking up some of the Tory votes, but maybe not as many from Labour, but who knows?
Could that be a constituency where we see the Leave vote consolidated around the Conservatives, plus local traditions pushing people in that direction, but the Remain vote is split between Labour and Lib Dems to let the Conservatives in?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's quite a few seats in London that look a bit like that, where the Tories don't really have... They could go down in vote share and still gain the seats, and this looks like one of the prime candidates.
Matthew Shalick, thank you very much. We'll speak to you next week. And now it's time for a new section of the podcast, the Big Five election questions. We're going to be asking these to our guests every week. Will, you're very much the guinea pig on this. The first question, what will you be doing during the campaign?
Well, during the campaign, I'll be, as I am today, doing various hits for Sky News. I'll be doing, giving my views on what we might expect in terms of the election. I'll be doing a lot of data preparation for election night. I'll be collecting, very, very geeky collection of data sets so that we can analyse the results as they come in, preparing some of the mob. We have to think about how we're going to project the result on election night once we've got 30, 40 seats. So we'll do a lot of rehearsals around that. We have rehearsals for the exit poll as well.
And you're working with Michael Thrasher at Sky News.
Yeah, so I've worked with Michael since 2017 election. We've got a team there. We work together analysing the election results as they come in. We also are part of the group that help organise the exit poll.
Will you be seeking to actively undermine Michael so as to take his job for the next election?
No, Michael's...
Why are you nodding so violently?
Michael's a much better on-screen performer than I am. I'll have to stick to podcasts myself.
And so, next question, what will you be doing during the election day itself?
Well, so I'll start off in a bunker broadcasting house with the BBC and ITV teams organising the exit poll. Between about 10 in the morning and 10 o'clock at night, they take our mobile phones off us and any forms of contact with the outside world, and we'll start receiving data drops from across the country as the exit poll fieldwork agents start sending us data in. And then the real clever people in the team will be modelling away, people like Steve Fisher and Uni Kuhar, and we'll be kind of milling around, having suggestions about how we might try and understand the data we're getting in.
I often imagine the exit poll team to be sitting around in a circle, much like a seance with John Curtis in the middle. But he explained...
What, levitating?
He explained when he was on the programme previously that that's not how it works. But I think that's still how a lot of people view it. And then what about election night itself?
So once we've got the estimates that we send to the broadcasters for the 10 o'clock bulletins, I'll hotfoot my way across to the Sky headquarters over at Austerlee, ready to start analysing the results as they come in. So normally there's a bit of a time lag before the first results come in. Normally it's up in Sunderland, the constituencies there. They're kind of very proud of trying to get the results in. I think Newcastle lately has been competing with them. There's a bit of competition in the northwest. So I'll run across there, and as soon as the results start coming in, we'll start analysing them to see how they perform against the last election. And as soon as we get, you know, maybe 10, 15, 20 results, we can start seeing if there's any pattern against, for example, Brexit vote or the number of graduates or students in a constituency.
Lastly then, what do you think will happen?
I think it's a real knife-edge election, and I've famously said at various points that I'm giving up forecasting, giving up prediction. I think we're really on a knife-edge as to a situation where I think a hung parliament's possible. As I said earlier, if you really push me, I think a Conservative's got to be in the driving seat for a majority. Any party that enters a campaign with, you know, a 10-plus point poll in the lead in the polls, you'd have to say is favourite. Now, lots can change, but, you know, today, as pollsters say, it's a snapshot, not a prediction.
Very well done. Just keep repeating.
It's the kind of the pollster's magic circle. We learn the tricks. So I think you'd have to say the Conservatives will be marginally ahead. I don't think it will be a huge blowout victory. You know, we could all the conventional wisdom could all be proven wrong, and Boris Johnson might have this kind of magical formula for the electorate. I think it'll be relatively tight. The Conservatives should edge it, but I'm sure you can have me back on at some point to eat something embarrassing. Yay. If it all goes horribly wrong.
I think I've decided, not that you've asked for anything, but that's fine. But I want want my prediction to be, I mean, which I'm nicking from a friend, but which is that Boris Johnson will get the exact same majority Cameron had and May lost. So we are just completely stuck in this never-ending...
strange sort of political groundhog day.
Yeah.
And then finally, who do you think will be the next Prime Minister after Boris Johnson?
That is a good question. I don't have a good answer. Yeah, exactly. So, do you know, so I would say, I don't think it'll be Jeremy Corbyn. And actually, funnily enough, I think if we do end up with a hung parliament, I really wouldn't be surprised if the whole coalition negotiations fall apart and we end up back in elections in February or whatever, just to cheer you all up. I'm not sure whether that's just my mischievous side wanting to predict that. I think it will be really difficult to put a coalition together, given that if Labour are in the driving seat to do that, in which case, I think the Conservatives will be in a position to do so. And therefore, you would have to say either, at that point, Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn may step aside, and you might be looking at, you know, a Jeremy Hunt type figure in the Conservatives, or someone on the Labour benches who, you know, a Keir Starmer or Jess Phillips or Elisa Nandy, who has to kind of step in. Angie Rayner. So, you know, actually, there's kind of a lot of variety, you know. So kind of, so I think, you know, it's a really open question that I'm not going to put my prediction to.
The really cursed prediction a friend made recently is that the next Tory PM will be Priti Patel. I'm not making judgment on this either way. I will keep my screaming for when I'm at home, but that is one prediction I've had recently.
That is indeed a prediction.
But she wasn't there, like, the announcement earlier today that she would be left, front and centre of this Tory election campaign, that she is being put forward. So, yeah.
Well, we will wait and see. Thank you, Will, for your big five. Just one last question. When does Christmas begin? When do you start to feel festive? Do you know it's Christmas time at all?
No, Christmas for me begins on the day after the election. Maybe the day after the election when I can start thinking about my Christmas shopping.
But do you think, generally speaking, when do the British public believe that it is Christmas?
Essentially after Halloween.
So you're saying 1st of November. Yeah. Marie, what's your suggestion?
I personally do not start feeling festive before the 15th of December.
But I would say
that it should start on the 1st of December. I'll accept that. Anything before that and you may as well be a murderer.
Well, more than 50%. It crossed the threshold of 50% on the 9th of December. So 9th of December is when the majority believe it is Christmas. 1st of November, I think, would be a bit miserable. but we'll see. Will Jennings, thank you very much. I was going to say the book is. He doesn't have a book. Catch Will on Sky News at various points. We'll be back next week. Thank you to Matthew Shaddick and all at Ladbrokes. Until next week, goodbye. Just quickly to say, if you really fancy getting your geek on, then I'm doing a live event at Greenwich University on Wednesday the 13th of November. Full details are at joetwyman.com/live. That's joetwyman.com/live. It's an open event, free to members of the public, so come along if you fancy hearing all about big data. Hope to see you there. Please remember to like, subscribe, review, all these different things that help people hear about us, and do tell all of your friends and many of the people that you don't know, even if you haven't enjoyed the podcast. This is a Poddo podcast produced by Nick Hilton, and our theme tune is by Joe Button.
For more details, go to podopods.com, and for sales and advertising, email nick@podopods.com.
And yes, that's spelled podopods.com.